Good morning and welcome to Shattering Myths. I am your host and tour guide, Yada. Each weekday morning, I strive to expose the beguiling and destructive myths associated with religion and politics, with patriotism in the media, and with military and economic schemes. If you listen, your eyes will be open, and you may ultimately change your mind towards some of these human institutions. Instead of merely presenting the news, my mission will be to help you understand what's occurring behind the headlines, all while predicting how these events will shape our world over the next 20 years. Then, during our second hour, we're going to engage Yah on his terms, by way of his one and only covenant and through his always dependable Torah teaching, so that with his guidance, you'll be able to replace your religion with reason and engage in a relationship. Our phone number for anyone who would like to question, criticize, or affirm what I have to say over the next 2 hours is 877-300-7645. I was sent an interesting quote from a good friend about a week ago, and I thought I would begin this program by sharing it with you. The person who wrote the quote I am no fan of, he is Dwight D. Eisenhower. Dwight Eisenhower, I thought, made and promoted a disastrous plan, that of invading Europe by crossing the English Channel and running directly into the teeth of German machine gun batteries, having our men do so, when a much better strategy would have been to land on the beaches of Greece, you know, where the sheer amount of access precluded the Germans from putting up meaningful defenses, and where having landed in Greece, we would have found a much more supportive local population to aid the advance of our troops. And mostly by advancing up through Greece, we could have not only entered the war much earlier and therefore saved millions of lives of those lost in the concentration camps, but have starved the Nazi war machine of its fuel supplies by going up through the Balkans and ultimately precluding the Soviet Union from enslaving Eastern Europe in the aftermath of the war. It would have been a vastly superior strategy. Churchill advanced it. Eisenhower was opposed to it. And so I'm not a fan of Mr. Eisenhower. However, this quote is an interesting quote, and it is worth our consideration. He said, "Every gun that is made, every warship which is launched, every rocket fired, signifies in the final sense a theft from those who hunger and are not fed, from those who are cold and not clothed." This world in arms is not spending money alone. It is spending the sweat of its laborers, the genius of its scientists, the hopes of its children. The cost of one modern heavy bomber is this: a modern brick school in more than 30 cities. It is two electric power plants, each serving a town of 60,000 population. It is two fine, fully equipped hospitals. It is some 50 miles of concrete pavement. We pay for a single fighter with a 500,000 bushels of wheat. We pay for a single destroyer with new homes that could have housed more than 8,000 people. This is not a way of life at all, in any true sense. Under the cloud of threatening war, it is humanity hanging from a cross of iron. End quote. That's a powerful statement. And it is part of what I've tried to convey so many times on this program, which is that not only does America outspend the rest of the world combined on its military, when you combine the defense spending along with our intelligence gathering, which is all tied to defense, we outspend the rest of the world combined. We are the world's largest seller of weapons. We are the most militaristic state in the history of the world. And the cost of that is actually debilitating. It cost the United States, its citizens, well over $700 billion a year to manage a defense force that has nothing to do with American defense. It is an offensive force. It is not a defensive force. And this is at a time that America's deficits are growing at between $1 trillion and $1.4 trillion a year. The money is being squandered. America is not safer. In fact, the use of our military has actually made us more vulnerable. Our invasion of Afghanistan pushed the most fundamentalist Muslims out of Afghanistan into Pakistan, which is a country they have undermined, and a country with nuclear weapons. That was suicidal. And it has gone horribly wrong in every possible way. Every way I predicted 11 or 12 years ago that it would end in this kind of disaster. Be counterproductive. Suicidal. Our invasion of Iraq is why the Islamic world is in such turmoil today. It is the leading cause for the civil war in Syria. That's because the United States invasion of Iraq gave Iraq to Iran. Iraq had been Iran's enemy. Now it is a client state of Iran. And it has broadened Iran's influence to not only include Iraq, but also Syria and Lebanon, as well as having the greatest influence over Gaza. As such, the SODs and American weapons are being deployed in Syria now to confront the Iranians and their influence. What we did was suicidal. We took Iraq, which had thwarted Iran's ability to develop nuclear weapons, gave Iraq to Iran, and therefore handed Iran its ability to conclude that program, which it will, and it will deploy its weapons in America. Counterproductive. America would be vastly safer if it did not deploy its military. And just think, if America, 10 years ago, rather than squandering $4 trillion on the suicidal and counterproductive invasions of Afghanistan and Iraq, had instead invested that kind of money in things like renewable energy. Just imagine what our economy would be like today. What if we had invested those kinds of things in infrastructure? What if we had invested those kinds of things in scientific research? Just think of how much better the world would be today if we had not squandered it building weapon systems. Moving to our second story of the morning, the United States was one of the few nations, one of about 2% of nations around the world that opposed this. But the Palestinian president, Mahmoud Abbas, now it's interesting to call him the Palestinian president. Of course, he was not elected. He lost the election by a 2/3 vote. Has told West Bank officials to prepare to put the word State of Palestine on public documents. Until now, passports, ID cards, driving licenses, and other documents have been stamped Palestinian Authority. The Palestinian Authority is an outgrowth of Bill Clinton and the Oslo Accords. It was a disaster. Everything the so-called Palestinians, the mythical people, agreed to do, they welched on. Everything that they demanded of Israel, Israel did. And it's like typical negotiations with Muslims. They hold the opposing party accountable and they do nothing themselves. Well, in this particular case, folks, there is no such thing as a Palestinian people. There is no such thing as a state of Palestine. Never has been. The only thing close to Palestinian is Philistia, and the Philistines were attacked and wiped out by both the Egyptians and the Assyrians. They ceased to exist as a people well over 2,000 years ago. There is no trace of them. There is no trace of their language. There is no trace of their culture. There is no trace of them genetically. They don't exist. And there was never a country even then called Palestine. None. It is a complete and utter myth. And even during the time the Philistines existed, the only area that they controlled is what is considered present-day Gaza. Nothing more. And they don't exist anymore. There's absolutely no record of them apart from the Torah. Yes, there are some claims that they are mentioned as sea people in Egyptian war reliefs. However, the sea peoples are the Phoenicians. The Phoenicians are Greeks. The Philistines were not. There is some claim that they are mentioned by the Hittites, and yet there's no record of that either, beyond the sea peoples, which were the Phoenicians. So there is absolutely no knowledge, even of the Philistines, apart from what is written in the Torah. Nothing. And if the Torah isn't true, then there wasn't even a Philistines. And if the Torah is true, then the land belongs to Yehudim and Yisrael. If you're going to use a name that is only known through the Torah to claim credibility, even though those people no longer exist, then you can't discount the Torah's primary theme, which is the land was given to Yehudim. A U.S. drone attack over the weekend killed another 8 suspected militants in Pakistan. Of course, Pakistan said, you know, you are violating our sovereignty. You are killing our citizens. You have no right to do that. Of course, Pakistan is correct. We have no international right to do it. And we are killing Pakistani civilians, and we are doing so without due process. It's simply a matter of this president saying, yeah, I don't like that guy. Kill him. What's interesting about this time is that this time the missiles are alleged to have killed Mullah Nazir. We talked about him about a month ago. He was the fellow that the media was so bullish on because he was replacing the old Pakistani Taliban leader who was dividing his attention between striking Pakistan and Afghanistan, and this fellow, no, he was going to just attack Americans in Afghanistan. So what a welcome change he was going to bring. Well, we killed him over the weekend. I'm Yada. This is Shattering Myths. To Shattering Myths, I am your host, Yada. You can engage in this discussion by calling 877-300-7645. It is interesting, of course, that the United States sees no issue with us flying drones and killing Pakistani civilians who want to kill us. But it is bad and therefore deserving that they should want to kill us, which makes killing them appropriate. Okay. We passed through the physical cliff debate a week ago, and in the midst of that debate, everyone seemed to lose sight of the fact that the physical cliff only existed because the Congress, a little over a year previous to that, was asked to raise the debt ceiling a couple of trillion dollars. And because they could not negotiate successfully any spending cuts from the president, they said, all right, we'll, and the U.S. Bond ratings were declining because the government couldn't pay its bills because, well, frankly, the government can't pay its bills without borrowing. So they said, all right, we'll do this, but we're going to impose automatic cuts that will go along with this debt ceiling increase. Well, the physical cliff came up. These cuts. It was only $100 billion annually that was a cut on government spending. That's in the 3.5 trillion range. Their cuts were $100 billion, so they were fairly insignificant anyway. And so in the midst of all that, the whole purpose of the fiscal cliff was lost, which was we need to cut government spending. And in the deal that was reached, not a single dime of spending was reduced. So now Obama returns from his vacation in Hawaii. And he says, first and foremost, that he's not going to negotiate with this Congress on this Congress paying its bills, which means he's not going to negotiate with them on raising the debt ceiling. Now, we have already surpassed the debt ceiling, by the way, and we're using sleight of hand to do so. What Geithner is doing is he's no longer transferring monies into pension government workers' pension plans, just giving them IOUs, in other words, indebting the U.S. to them, and he is not transferring money to states as part of pension plan reimbursements either. Again, indebting the United States by way of IOUs. This is an interesting tactic because what it does is it says that the unfunded mandates of Social Security and Medicare, which now total about $40 trillion, that's the amount the United States has promised to pay, that it has no funds to pay, that those unfunded mandates should be considered debt. Because right now, that is how the government is funding its spending, is by using these kinds of unfunded mandates to delay payment, increasing debt. Now, that means that rather than the federal deficit being $16.4 trillion, it is actually in the range of $55 trillion. In other words, the United States is by four times the most indebted nation on earth. Well, so Obama warned that he will not negotiate on the debt ceiling. In other words, he's going to give absolutely nothing to have the debt ceiling increased. Now, he is only part of the government, but when the sitting president of the Democratic Party says we won't negotiate, just as he didn't negotiate in the fiscal cliff, then the Democrats in Congress and the Senate don't negotiate, and they didn't on the fiscal cliff. So here we are now that we are facing another showdown on raising the debt ceiling, and there will be no concessions of any kind from the Democrats or this administration on cutting spending. Do you think we're in a serious problem or what? This is a quote from this president. We need to do more to put Americans back to work, which means I want to spend more, while also putting this country on the path to pay down its debt. Now, that statement, to pay down its debt, that means to reduce the aggregate deficit. Do you understand that with us accumulating debt at the rate of over $1 trillion a year, in fact, the last 4 years have averaged closer to $1.4 trillion a year, that to pay down our debt, we would have to cut the federal budget annually by a minimum of $1.5 trillion a year. Now, that's assuming that you also cut the fact that, and add to that, the rate of increase in the entitlement programs, which takes it now to about $1.7 trillion a year, and that assumes that we never pay interest on our existing debt, which would double that to $3 trillion a year. Which means, folks, if we're going to pay down our debt, our cuts can't be $100,000. They have to be in the trillions. Welcome back to Shattering Myths. You can call this program by dialing toll-free, 877-300-7645. We were considering President Barack Hussein Obama's quote on the debt ceiling discussion. The first comment was, we need to do more to put Americans back to work. That's code for more spending, more government spending, which is the only thing that he knows. He is a communist, and I don't say that because I apply labels without thinking. It's not a pejorative statement, just a statement that is accurate. If you consider his last State of the Union address on the economy, there is no other rational way to evaluate the man's politic other than to say he's a communist. He wants to control the U.S. economy the same way the commander-in-chief controls the U.S. military. Now, moving to this statement, he then says that the country needs to be put on a path to pay down its debt. Well, the only way the country can be put on a path to pay down its debt is to cut government spending by 50% across the board. We need to cut spending between $1 and $2 trillion a year. Now, this $100 billion cut that would have been part of the fiscal cliff was considered catastrophic. And yet it needs to be between 15 and 20 times greater than that for us to be on a path to pay down our debt. He then says our economy can't afford more protracted slowdowns or manufactured crises along the way. The economy cannot handle, cannot afford a slowdown, which would mean a reduction in government spending. It's the only thing our economy has to have any hope of enduring. Now, Republicans have indicated that they're ready for another fight, although they just rolled over and played dead the last time, over U.S. debt ceilings. The Representative Dave Camp, delivering his party's weekly address, warned that, at least indirectly, that they would expect spending cuts in return to for raising the ceiling again. Well, they thought they negotiated them the last time, then rolled over and played dead. Many of our Democratic colleagues don't seem to get it, he said. Throughout the fiscal cliff discussions, the president and Democrats who control Washington repeatedly refused to make any meaningful steps to make Washington live within its means. Yes, we have not lived within our means for a very, very long time. You have to go back to well before LBJ, since America has lived within its means. As we turn our attention towards the future discussions on the debt limit and the budget, we must identify responsible ways to tackle Washington's wasteful spending. Well, the problem is that the majority of Americans no longer think that Washington's spending is wasteful because it's wasted on them. And they don't consider themselves a waste. So the fact that we are playing this game of wealth redistribution doesn't seem to bother those who are morally impaired. And if you are one of those who voted for more wealth redistribution, for this myth that we can prosper by taking money away from those who've earned it and giving it to those who have not, if that is the myth that you are promoting, if that is your ignorance and your irrational and immoral stand, then we have a serious problem. You have a serious problem. It is a game that is nothing short of economic pedophilia. We're abusing our children, and no one seems to get it. No one seems to care. This quote goes on to say, if Congress refuses to give the United States the ability to pay its bills on time, the consequence, oh, this is now from the president, rather than being responsible and cutting spending, he says, if Congress refuses to give the United States the ability to pay its bills on time, which means to borrow, because the United States has no ability to pay its bills without borrowing, the consequence for the entire global economy could be catastrophic. Our families and our businesses cannot afford that dangerous game again. The dangerous game is continuing to raise the debt ceiling, to continue to act as if it doesn't matter. Obama said he's willing to do more on deficit reduction. More, he's done nothing. And suggested that the hike in tax rates for the wealthy was not the lax tax change he expected to make. This is a quote. Spending cuts must be balanced with more reforms to our tax code. You know, that was the ploy this last time. And then when the Republicans capitulated on raising taxes, then guess what happened? The Democrats and Obama were unwilling to even discuss spending cuts. And now he's rolling out the same myth. Oh, we'll discuss a balanced approach to spending cuts with reforms to the tax code, which means increasing taxes. But there will be no reductions, only increases in taxes. The wealthiest individuals, he said, and the biggest corporations shouldn't be able to take advantage of loopholes and deductions that aren't available to most Americans. The fact is, the wealthiest individuals have fewer loopholes to take advantage of than do the average Americans. And average Americans pay no tax. Their loopholes are so gargantuan that the average American pays no tax at all, no federal tax. And the vast majority of loopholes are established to the advantage of the average individual. The wealthiest Americans pay 40 times more in tax than do the next 25%. And, of course, you can't compare what the wealthiest Americans pay to the average American, because the average American pays nothing. And zero divided by anything is infinite. We have a serious problem that is getting worse because we don't understand how to tackle it. We don't even understand what caused the problem in America, which is greed. And it's not the greed of individuals who are successful, wanting to keep the majority of what they have earned. It's the greed of those who are not successful and expect everyone else to coddle them, who are willing to steal from those who are productive to satiate their cravings. They're covetous. It is a recipe for disaster. It is why America, as we know this nation as a sovereign state, will not represent, will not even resemble what it has been in 10 to 20 years. It will be anarchy here. It's unavoidable. There's a story which has emerged from Kabul, Afghanistan. It was printed last week in the New York Times. It is the story of a young Afghan soldier's hatred for Americans that grew murderous. And it tells of him reaching out to the Taliban. Now, this story is important only because most of those who have turned rogue, those Afghan soldiers who America puts in fancy uniforms, puts in fancy trucks with Allahu Akbar painted on the sides, who equips with fancy weapons, that most of them who kill Americans are killed in the process of doing their murderous deed. Well, this fellow not only wasn't killed, he escaped. So he is in a position to be interviewed because the media has access to the Taliban. One of the things you find about fundamentalist Muslims who are jihadists is they want to communicate with the press because the press is so easy to manipulate. It is very easy for fundamentalist Muslims to convey propaganda about their cause to the world through the gullible media. And so in this case, it was a New York Times journalist who had access to this individual, an individual who the United States has sent drones out to kill and does not seem to be able to kill, but the New York Times journalist was able to interview him. The soldier, who simply wants to be called Mahmoud, is 22 years old. He said in May that he told the insurgents, insurgents is journalistic code for jihadist, for fundamentalist Islamic terrorist, that his plan was to shoot Americans the next time they visited the outpost where he was based in northeastern Afghanistan. And then he said he asked the Taliban to take him in if he escaped. He said even the Taliban didn't think that I would be able to do this, Mahmoud said during his interview with the New York Times. He proved them wrong days later, on the morning of May 11th, when he opened fire on American trainers who had gone to the outpost in the mountains of the Kunar province. One American was killed and two others were wounded. Mahmoud escaped in the ensuing confusion, and he remains free in Kunar after the Taliban welcomed him into their ranks. Now, of course, this is in northeastern Afghanistan. If you're keeping track, northeastern Afghanistan was a place where the Taliban were non-existent. That's where the Northern Alliance, which was the enemy of the Taliban, had resided. They controlled northeastern Afghanistan. But one of the things the United States did is that we are not very good at honoring our allegiances to allies. And even though the Northern Alliance was an ally of America, We did not protect them, and they have subsequently been annihilated by the Taliban, and the Taliban has taken over that territory. Now, speaking of the day that he murdered the Americans, Mahmoud said, "It was my proudest day." Such insider attacks by Afghan security forces on their Western allies became, quote, the signature violence of 2012, in the words of one American official, and I've shared this with you before. IEDs are no longer the leading cause of death of Americans in Afghanistan. It's now the very, Afghani troops that we are arming and equipping. They're taking the training and the weapons and turning them on the trainers. It is a sign to even those who are the most ardent hawks that we have no chance of success in Afghanistan. This article continues to read, "The surge in attacks has provided the clearest sign yet that American resentment of, or excuse me, that Afghan resentment of foreigners is becoming unmanageable. The American officials have expressed worries about this, its disruptive effects on the training mission that is at the core of the American withdrawal in 2014. This is a direct quote. "It is a game changer on all levels," said First Sergeant Joseph Hisong, an American who helped fight off the insider attack by Taliban soldiers that left two men in his unit dead. Why don't we just simply admit that we have failed? It's like Vietnam. It was obvious that we had failed in Vietnam after 5,000 Americans had sacrificed their lives for nothing. Why did we stay and allow the death toll to rise upwards to 60,000? Why are we still in Afghanistan? This war cannot be won. It's obvious this war cannot be won. We made a bad situation worse. Let's leave before we lose more lives. Shattering this, I'm your host, Yadav. We're considering one of the great problems of Afghanistan, and it's not exactly like Afghanistan is not rife with hundreds of unresolvable issues, but this notion that we're going to transition out of Afghanistan successfully by having trained, armed, and equipped Afghanis to replace us in the enforcement role is about as stupid as believing that that was going to happen in Vietnam. And of course, we spent 5 years of the last 5 years of Vietnam trying to train and equip the South Vietnamese to fight their own battles, and all that did was lead to the death of more individuals. Well, in Afghanistan, the problem is far worse, because at least in South Vietnam, we shared a somewhat similar value system. With the Afghanis, who are Muslims, their value system and the value systems that Americans have, the soldiers have been raised in, are opposites. They're not going to get along. The things that Americans would consider repulsive, the Afghanis consider wonderful. The things that Afghanis consider wonderful, Americans consider repulsive. There is no way that this has any chance of working. It was obvious to anyone who had read anything about Muhammad and Islam that this mission was failed from the beginning. Well, this article continues. Cultural clashes have contributed, it says, to some of the insider attacks. No, they've contributed to all of them. With Afghani soldiers and police officers becoming enraged by what they see as rude and abusive behavior by Americans close to them. You see, they glamorize anything that Americans do that they consider to be an insult. One of the things that is universal about Islam is arrogance. It is a consequence of the wannabe God of Islam, who is Satan. Allah spends all of his time in hell torturing those who do not surrender to him. He is never associated with love. In fact, the word love is not even in the Quran. And Allah is never depicted in heaven. He's only depicted in hell torturing unbelievers. Allah is modeled directly off of Satan. Satan's arrogance is what got him thrown out of heaven. Satan's arrogance is what permeates Muslims. And so they are so insecure and so arrogant that they view as anything that is not just overwhelmingly supportive of all of their failures as a glowing endorsement of them to be an insult. Now, you know, it's pretty hard to have a glowing retort of the influence of Islam while you're in Afghanistan. I mean, the streets aren't paved. There's very little access to electricity, to running water, to schools. It is abject poverty, as is most of the Islamic world. And so you look at that, and you look at their treatment of women, you look at their treatment of children and pedophilia, you look at their unwillingness to invest in education or infrastructure, and just this despicable behavior stuck in the past, in an uncivilized past, and it's extraordinarily difficult to find something to praise. And so everything is looked at like it's an insult. And it's hard to blame the American troops. If you were in Vietnam, for example, and the people you were supposed to be helping, fighting for, are the ones that are bringing grenades into your midst and blowing themselves up and you up with them, it's pretty hard to trust the people. Well, the same thing is true in Afghanistan. But behind it all, the article reads, many senior coalition and Afghan officials are now concluding that after nearly 12 years of war, the view of foreigners held by most Afghans has come to mirror that of the Taliban. In other words, the average Afghani citizen views America exactly the way the Taliban does. Why? What does the Taliban and the average Afghani have in common? Islam. Hope has turned to hatred. And some will find reason to act on those feelings. By the way, hope has not turned to hatred. There has never been any hope. There has only been hatred. Now, a great percentage, this article says, of the insider attacks have the enemy narrative. The enemy narrative here, this is a quote from someone, so the enemy might be the Taliban from this individual's point of view. The enemy is actually Islam. The narrative that the infidels have to be driven out. Now, infidel is an Islamic term, which proves my point, but not that of the individual making this quote. Some were inside of them, but they aren't directed by the enemy. So in other words, this person is acknowledging that the average Afghan, including those who are in the military, have within them this desire to drive infidels out, to kill them, but it isn't being directed by the Taliban. What do you think is directing it? Islam?
Alex Jones here with a message that could revolutionize health in this country. Going back about a year and a half ago, I began to learn about the incredible health effects of young